Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Multiple Myeloma. And today is part one of a two-part series on living with multiple myeloma. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. So we have on the call today over 650 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants on the call today from Canada, France, Netherlands, Turkey, and United Kingdom. So this is a bit of a global call. We have people from really all over the world. Now, today's program has been made possible by Celgene Corporation, an educational donation provided by Amgen, and supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc. And I really want to thank them, and administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program today and their corporate collaboration and partnership in making this today's program possible, but this two-part series possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, really just, and actually our two medical speakers, hematologic oncologists, have been with us for many years, and they have lots of wonderful information to share with you today. So I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. William Bensinger. Dr. Bensinger is with the Center for Blood Disorders and Stem Cell Transplantation, and he's program leader, Multiple Myeloma Clinical Research Program, Swedish Cancer Institute in Seattle, Washington. And Dr. Bensinger is going to be addressing an overview of multiple myeloma, current standard of care, the role of transplantation and when to consider transplantation, and new treatment approaches. And it's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bensinger.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's really a pleasure and a great honor to be here. I've always enjoyed these conferences, and it's just this is a wonderful time to address everyone here. So what is multiple myeloma? This is a cancer of the bone marrow, and specifically it's a cancer that involves plasma cells. These are antibody-producing cells in our body. And this is a cell that normally resides in the marrow and has the ability to make antibodies to help protect us from infection, but also plays a role in bone metabolism. Now, when these cells, one of these plasma cells becomes cancerous, it fills up the bone marrow in an uncontrolled fashion. This is the hallmark of what cancer is. It's cells that don't obey the laws of our bodies and know when to quit reproducing. These cells typically, but not always, produce large amounts of proteins we call monoclonal proteins that appear in our blood and sometimes our urine. And as the marrow fills up, these cells cause or lead to a lot of problems: anemia, low blood cells, kidney problems, kidney failure, bone disease or high calcium levels, and also frequent infections. Now, the exact cause of myeloma is not known, but it is increasingly observed that genetic alterations in the plasma cell lead to the development of the disease. Now, in the U.S., there are roughly 27,000 new cases diagnosed every year, and at any one time, about 90,000 people in the U.S. have this disease. This is a disease generally of older patients. The median age is about 69 years, and this is important as some treatments, such as stem cell transplant, tend to be limited to younger patients, patients generally under 70. Now, the disease is treatable with multiple types of chemotherapies, but is generally, at least in the past, not thought to be curable with conventional therapy. However, with the new drugs and the use of stem cell transplantation, survival has more than doubled. And also with the new drugs that have become available that I'll talk about in a minute, the rhetoric of a lot of us is changing, and we actually think that we're going to be able to cure a proportion of patients with this disease as time goes on. Now, as I said, the diagnosis of myeloma is based on finding these abnormal cells in the bone marrow, typically with proteins in the urine or blood. Now, we generally make a distinction between a plasma cell disorder we call MGUS, which there is these proteins that appear, but and plasma cells in the marrow, but at generally at lower levels. And typically, patients don't have the myeloma-defining events. We use the acronym CRAB frequently, which is elevated calcium, kidney problems, anemia, or bone disease with destruction of bone in certain areas. This has been the classic, this CRAB acronym has been the classic one used to define when to treat patients. Increasingly, though, we're recognizing that there are subpopulations of what we call asymptomatic myeloma that have such a high level of disease that they are very likely to develop symptomatic disease in short order. And these patients are beginning to be classified as having symptomatic disease. Now, typically patients may have bone pain, they may have fatigue, weight loss, sometimes they'll have neuropathy or frequent infections, but as many as a quarter of patients are asymptomatic at the time of diagnosis. Now, the treatment is targeted to control the myeloma disease activity and to improve disease symptoms. So the bone damage that occurs, we target the disease to reduce the incidence of bone problems or combat high calcium from bone destruction, to try to improve anemia so that the red cell count goes up and patients don't suffer from fatigue or shortness of breath, improve kidney function that may be damaged in the course of this disease, and to reduce frequent infections. At the same time, this treatment should minimize the treatment-related symptoms. That is, the drugs themselves often have side effects, and we'd like to minimize that. And ultimately, we want to prolong the remission, if not cure the disease, which is the ideal goal of all treatment, I think. Now, myeloma usually responds to multiple types of combination therapies, and we're seeing response rates at really 100% now for most of the newer combinations. About half or more of the patients will develop what we call complete responses, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. Stem cell transplant remains an important component of therapy, and there is recent data on that to support it. So while it is hard to eradicate the disease, it's becoming easier to treat, and we're getting longer and deeper remissions for the majority of our patients. Now, we measure treatment response, what we call a complete response, which means the protein disappears from the blood and urine, and the abnormal plasma cells disappear from the bone marrow. But as we've achieved this in greater numbers of patients, we're also finding that deeper levels of response are important. And so there are new terms that have come up, which we call stringent complete response, and now more what we call molecular remissions, where we're using more and more sensitive techniques to detect tiny amounts of disease. And if we found that if you can get a molecular remission, this is associated with the best outcomes in terms of disease control, remaining in remission, and improved survival. Now, how about the drugs? We have a series of old drugs that are standbys and are important in the treatment of the disease. They can be broadly classified into steroids or corticosteroids. The drugs commonly in that class are prednisone or dexamethasone. We have alkylating agents, and these drugs include cyclophosphamide, melphalan, bendamustine. anthracyclines, doxorubicin, or a pegylated form is used. These are less commonly used, but still one of the drugs that can be used. And then we have the newer drugs. The first class that has really become part of the game changer are the immunomodulatory drugs. And these are drugs called thalidomide or lenalidomide, and more recently pomalidomide. The next class that has been used and discovered is the proteasome inhibitors, of which we have bortezomib and a newer one called carfilzomib. Now, we have two new classes of drugs that have become approved in the last year. There's a class called histone deacetylase inhibitors, of which panobinostat is the drug, and then a brand new class of called monoclonal antibodies. These are a type of immunotherapy. And those drugs are elotuzumab and daratumumab. And these are a very important component of some of the new things that have happened. We also, last year, had four new drugs approved. I mentioned the panobinostat, elotuzumab, and daratumumab. But we also had an oral proteasome inhibitor called ixazomib approved. And these drugs really have become important in terms of the management of the disease. Now, in terms of sequencing, we generally recommend that patients who need therapy get initial treatment designed, hopefully, to maximize the response. If patients are eligible for transplant, we recommend a stem cell transplant as part of the initial therapy. And then afterward, there is an increasing interest in using maintenance therapy or continuous therapy, since there are lots of data now to show that this prolongs remissions and in many cases can improve survival. But still at the present time, patients are going to relapse. And when they've relapsed, they can receive a stem cell transplant sometimes for a second time. Or if they haven't had a transplant, they can receive a transplant later in the course of the disease. And then, of course, there are many new drugs, which I've mentioned a few of. In general, there's increasing data that three drug combinations are superior to two drug combinations. The caveat to that is, I think, in older patients who may not tolerate a three-drug regimen as well, there has to be individual treatment decisions made about the risks and the benefits of three drugs versus two drugs. But typical combinations that are commonly used now are bortezomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. Bortezomib is also used with Doxil and dexamethasone, or cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. More recently, carfilzomib, the second-generation proteasome inhibitor, can be used with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. In older non-transplant patients, especially ones with that have a poor performance status, two drugs such as lenalidomide and dex may be used. But as I will tell you, there is some data that three drugs may be superior even in this even in these older patients. So transplant is an important component of therapy, and that's because high-dose chemotherapy, generally with melphalan followed by the use of autologous stem cells, has been shown to have higher rates of complete remission than conventional therapy. And disease-free survival is better, and most trials have shown survival advantages. It really is a standard of care, I think, for most eligible patients. It's generally well tolerated in patients up to 65 or 70. It's less commonly used in older patients because there are side effects, and they become more important in older patients. There is some data to suggest that a tandem transplant may be useful, but that's a little bit more controversial. A tandem transplant means two transplants done within 6 months of each other. Now, the other type of transplant that is less used are donor transplants, where a brother or sister or even an unrelated donor can donate stem cells. And these transplants are termed allogeneic transplants. They have a higher initial toxicity and a greater risk of death, and there is the potential for a condition known as graft versus host disease. But they may have better anti-tumor effects in some patients and are used, still used for some patients. They are, though, generally considered more investigational than an autologous transplant, which I think is clearly a standard of care. Now, generally, in terms of who is a candidate for autologous transplant, these are patients who have good performance status, adequate organ function, but patients with even relapsed or refractory disease can benefit in some cases from autologous transplant. As I said, we generally offer this to patients under the age of 70, but there are exceptions to this, and older patients sometimes benefit. Now, more recently, there have been some trials that have shown superiority of some combinations used for initial therapy. So combinations of bortezomib, thalidomide, and dexamethasone. A triplet is better than two drugs, thalidomide and dexamethasone. There was also some recent data from the recent hematology meeting in December that the combination of bortezomib, thalidomide, and dexamethasone was better than bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone. There was also data showing that a stem cell transplant was superior after induction therapy with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. So in this trial, everybody received bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, and then after three cycles of therapy, patients either had a transplant followed by two more cycles of the three-drug combination, or the transplant was not done and patients just stayed on this for a total of eight cycles, the three drugs. That trial showed that autologous transplant was superior in terms of response rates and disease control. There was also interesting data for a population of patients that are generally not offered transplant, in which the same combination of bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone was compared to just the doublet of lenalidomide and dexamethasone for eight cycles followed by maintenance. And the three-drug combination, even in the older non-transplant-eligible patients, showed that the three drugs were better in terms of response, progression-free survival, and even overall survival, which was a surprise, I think, for many of us. So as I said, there is increasing data showing three-drug combinations may be better than two. Now, the majority of patients are going to relapse, and some of the recent data has shown that combinations of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dex, three drugs, are better than two, the lenalidomide-dex combination. There was also a direct comparison of carfilzomib dex with bortezomib and dex showing superiority of the carfilzomib combination. Other interesting data that was reported was the use of one of the new immunotherapy drugs, elotuzumab, with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, and that three-drug combination was shown to be superior for the two-drug combination in patients who'd relapsed. There was similar data shown for the oral proteasome inhibitor ixazomib with lenalidomide and dex, showing that that three-drug combination was better than two. There was earlier data that was not presented at ASH showing that the histone deacetylase inhibitor, panobinostat, in combination with bortezomib and dex was also better than a two-drug combination. So I'm sure you see a theme here with three drugs being better than two for most of these combinations in the relapse setting as well. The other final interesting bit of information was a drug called daratumumab, which is another immunotherapy, a new monoclonal antibody. And this showed a single agent activity in relapsed patients who'd failed multiple other therapies. And these new immunotherapies are really exciting. There are promising new drugs on the horizon, and I think Nupur will have more to say about it. But briefly, there's another immunotherapy with a PD-1 inhibitor. This is an antibody that blocks T cells from attacking tumor cells, and this antibody blocks the or unblocks these cells so they can are free to attack tumor cells. There's some interesting data with CAR T cells, which are really a technique for taking the patient's own T cells and turning them into killer cells against the patient's own tumor. There are new histone deacetylase inhibitors that are being evaluated that look promising, and there's another interesting class of drugs called nuclear protein transport inhibitors that look very good as well. So in general, I think it's an exciting time to be a researcher in this field because I think we're seeing tremendous progress in the treatment of the disease. And we really are changing the rhetoric about how we think we're going to manage patients going forward. And with that, I'll finish and turn it over to Nuper.
Thank you very much, Dr. Benzinger. That was really outstanding and really changed the language that's used in terms of talking about treating multiple myeloma and really giving all sorts of options to people. So this is really wonderful to hear. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Nupur Rajay. Dr. Rajay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Rajay is going to address the role of clinical trials and the contribution treatment options, reducing complications of bone disease over time, managing symptoms, side effects, discomfort, and pain, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. And I know she's also going to continue to address, of course, the new approaches as well. So it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Rajay.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. And as always, it is fantastic to be on this call today. This is a very, very exciting time in myeloma, and you heard the enthusiasm in Dr. Benzinger's voice here, and it's truly been pretty remarkable when it comes to therapies for multiple myeloma. Dr. Benzinger has already given all of you an excellent overview of myeloma. He's talked about all of the different therapeutic options, and he's highlighted some of the newer, more novel ones as well. And what I will try and do in the next several minutes is highlight some of the new significant research options and how, in fact, they've impacted the care of all of you and how you, in fact, have contributed to a lot of the approvals which we've been so fortunate to have over the last year. We'll talk about the importance, obviously, of clinical trials in that context. We'll talk about some of the disease-related problems that some of you or a lot of you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis and try and figure out how to manage some of the symptoms, some of the side effects, talk about pain, discomfort. And I think the most important thing which we tend to forget to do is remind you that, you are not alone in all of this. This is a team effort here. We like to believe that myeloma is a team event, and it's you and who is the center of all of this, and your caregivers, your care team is essentially there to help you go through this journey. And as you've just heard in the last 15 minutes from Dr. Benzinger, the use of novel therapies has really resulted in a transformation of myeloma. It is becoming very, very chronic. People are living much, much longer with this disease, and there is a lot of exciting news in terms of research as well. What we have seen, and you heard the theme from Dr. Benzinger's talk a little while back, is we're using all of these drugs now in combination. And the reason we can actually safely and easily do that is these are newer drugs which combine well and don't have the same old side effects that we are generally used to seeing with traditional chemotherapy. So our focus has really shifted to using combination approaches, and with this, the goal of treatment is transforming even this chronicity of the disease into hopefully a curable disease in the very near future. We've had excellent efficacy and tolerability of most of these combinations. We're using some of the drugs which Dr. Benzinger has mentioned, such as carfilzomib, which is an intravenous proteasome inhibitor. We've also used the newest IMID now, which is pomalidomide, and this is now becoming fairly routinely used in myeloma. We have a bunch of other novel drugs, some of which were mentioned by Dr. Benzinger, and these are in the context of clinical trials right now. He talked a little bit about the new oral proteasome inhibitor called ixazomib, and this ixazomib is really a drug which is used in combination with lenalidomide. And the neat thing about ixazomib is it's an oral proteasome inhibitor which you can take once a week. So just one pill once a week, 3 weeks in a row, and this can help control your myeloma. The good news with ixazomib is it really doesn't cause the kind of neuropathy which some of you are used to seeing with older drugs like bortezomib. When I say bortezomib is an older drug, it just tells you how much we've been able to get to in the last 10 to 15 years with the treatment of myeloma. Some of the other new drugs which were approved, and, 2015 was almost like a blockbuster year for multiple myeloma, where we had 4 new drugs approved. We have an HDAC inhibitor called panobinostat. This was approved in combination with bortezomib, and this combination is actually quite useful when your disease becomes active again. We are working on newer HDAC or histone deacetylase inhibitors, and these are probably a little better tolerated than panobinostat. These are in clinical trials as we speak. One of them is called ricalinostat, and the other one is a pill called ACY-241. And when you combine these with an immunomodulatory drug, either lenalidomide or pomalidomide, we're seeing people respond quite well to these combinations, and patients tend to stay on these drugs for a very, very long time. The other nice thing, again mentioned by Dr. Benzinger, was the approval of a couple of monoclonal antibodies. So daratumumab is a monoclonal antibody directed against a protein called CD38. This is a protein which is present on everybody's myeloma cells. And with daratumumab, we are seeing single-agent activity in patients who've had pretty much all other treatments before. So you've received bortezomib, you've received carfilzomib, you've seen lenalidomide and pomalidomide, and if the disease comes back after that, daratumumab is able to control the disease in a significant proportion of patients. Another monoclonal antibody which was approved late last year was elotuzumab. Elotuzumab is along the same lines as helping activate your immune system. It works by activating certain immune cells in your body called natural killer cells, and this, when combined with a drug like lenalidomide, you're able to have your myeloma under good control for a protracted period of time. There are other monoclonal antibodies against CD38 like daratumumab. The newer one is called isatuximab, and this one is in clinical trials as we speak. Obviously, we're very excited about immuno-oncology in general in the whole realm of oncology, but specifically so in multiple myeloma as well. The new things which you will be hearing about, I am sure, later on this year and early next year would be a class of drugs called checkpoint blockade inhibitors. So these are drugs or monoclonal antibodies which can then take off the brakes on your immune system. So all of us have an immune system, but when you have a cancer, your immune system gets disrupted. And what's happened over the last several years is we've been able to understand what it is that causes that immune system to not work properly. And the good news is we have drugs against these different blockade points, and we are able to release those brakes and so that your immune system can start working well again. And you're going to hear about drugs like pembrolizumab, nivolumab, and others like PD-1, PD-L1 blockade, which will essentially be used in combination with some of the other drugs we have for multiple myeloma. Dr. Benzinger mentioned another very interesting approach we are all very excited about, and this comes under the realm of cellular therapies, and this is called CAR T-cell treatment. And what that essentially means is that we take your T cells, educate your T cells to recognize your myeloma cells, and give those back to you so that they can track down the myeloma and get rid of the myeloma. So this is in clinical trials as we speak, and this seems to be a very promising strategy going forward. Other things which we are doing in the context of myeloma is vaccination strategies. So almost like we are creating a vaccine outside your body and giving that back to you so that that vaccine is able to recognize your myeloma as foreign to your body and hopefully try and get rid of this. There are other newer drugs which have different mechanisms of action. One of them is called Filanisib. This is a nuclear export transport inhibitor, and the or selinexor, which is a nuclear export protein inhibitor, and another one called a kinesin spindle inhibitor, Filanisib, and we'll see where those drugs go. They're being studied in combination as we speak. Now, because of all of this rapid evolution in available therapies, I think it's extremely important that you connect with your medical team. You seek out these clinical trials. There are excellent websites online. The NCI has a fantastic website which essentially lists every clinical trial which is happening as we speak. It can be a little overwhelming, which is why I think connecting with your healthcare providers to give you the guidance as to whether or not any of these clinical trials are appropriate for you would be the right thing to do. Shifting gears a little bit now, we'll talk some about symptom and pain management and focus mainly on issues pertaining to your myeloma. When you're first diagnosed with myeloma, you certainly can have symptoms from the myeloma, and that in itself can get a whole lot better after you actually take care of the disease in itself. So taking care of the myeloma with the anti-myeloma treatment will help some of the symptoms associated with myeloma. And some of the common symptoms are symptoms associated with bone disease, such as bone pain. You do see anemia because of bone marrow involvement from the myeloma. Sometimes you can have other things like your increase in calcium, you can develop fractures in your bones, and so on and so forth. So for bone disease specifically, most patients should be on a bone-targeted agent. They should be getting a bisphosphonate, and we commonly use a drug called pomidronate or another one called zoledronic acid. And this is something you need to be on initially, at least on a monthly basis. And then after that, we are able to shift to every 3 months or so. What these drugs do is help reduce complications from bone disease, such as bony pains, such as fractures, which can actually cause significantly impact your quality of life. But if you're on these, at least these drugs are able to reduce some of these complications by about 50% or so. One thing to remember is make sure that your vitamin D levels have been checked and your calcium levels have been checked. And while on these drugs, you should be getting supplemental calcium, about 500 a day, and you should also be replete with vitamin D so that some of these drugs work better. We are working on a monoclonal antibody as well. This is called denosumab. It's pretty much approved in every other cancer which affects bones. For myeloma, our hope is we will see the data which comes out later on this year, and depending on that, this will be used more widely. This is a drug which can be given as a subcutaneous shot, again, once a month. It's very effective in taking care of your bony problems. There are some local measures which I think it's important for you to think about should you have problems with your spine, such as compression fractures. There are procedures such as vertebral augmentation procedures, so kyphoplasties or vertebroplasties are sometimes used in the setting. We, along with other treatment for myeloma, are working on novel bone agents also in myeloma. These are in very early phase trials, but the hope is that they will soon be available to the broader community as well once we finish up with these clinical trials. And again, you know, I look at this more as a good news problem. We have honestly translated myeloma into a very long-term disease, and with that we do start seeing long-term toxicities. So we are seeing problems such as osteonecrosis of the jaw. It happens in a minority of patients, about 3% of patients, and it happens only because people have lived long enough to receive bisphosphonates for a very, very long time. The thing to do with osteonecrosis of the jaw is obviously they are related to bisphosphonates or some of your bone-targeted agents. You know, make sure you've seen a dentist. The things to avoid is extraction of teeth or any kind of surgical intervention, but try and manage it conservatively, keep the oral cavity clean, make sure you get your cleanings, and prevent infections. Other symptoms sometimes which can be long-standing, such as anemia, sometimes can be helped with drugs like erythropoietin. Again, make sure you've communicated with your healthcare provider before you go on to a growth factor such as erythropoietin, because it's important to understand why you're anemic. But in certain patients who have renal dysfunction and myeloma, drugs like erythropoietin can actually be quite helpful in patients. Now, although all of these agents are very effective and are in general extremely well tolerated, as I've mentioned, and we're using most of them in combinations, well, you know, when you're on some of these drugs for protracted periods of time, you are going to have problems from the drugs itself, and I think it's important that we recognize those problems, and it's important that you communicate those to your healthcare providers. We know that with the IMIDs, specifically lenalidomide, pomalidomide, thalidomide, be aware of blood clots. You should be on aspirin for sure, and in certain situations we will also consider using a blood thinner. We know about neuropathy, more common with bortezomib. With the newer drugs, we don't see as much neuropathy. We do sometimes see neuropathy with the IMIDs as well, and this is something which can be quite frustrating because it's a chronic problem. It's a problem which patients have to deal with all along. This is something you absolutely need to let your healthcare providers know. My recommendation generally is when you're having neuropathy, make sure you're well B supplemented. So vitamin B6, B12 is generally good for you. And the other thing is, you know, try and continue with exercise, try and remain as mobile as possible because it does help. There are certain dietary supplements which are used by some, like alpha-lipoic acid and L-carnitine, and sure, you can use them. They're all good nerve health, kind of nerve protectant medications. Now, given the complexity of both the symptoms from the disease itself as well as symptoms from some of your treatments that we give you, and given that you stay on treatment now for years, we've now advocated using maintenance treatment generally in most patients. I think it's really very, very important that you tell and communicate about your symptoms and your concerns with your caregivers, with your healthcare providers, because there may be ways and means of trying to mitigate these for sure. Again, I cannot underscore the importance of trying to participate in clinical trials if you can. So if there's something which is available for you, I think please go ahead and look that up and try and do it. I will tell you that the credit for where we are with all of these new, I think we have about 12 new FDA-approved drugs, is a testament to your willingness to participate in our clinical trials, and we are extremely grateful for this. And with that, I'm going to conclude, Carolyn. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ajay. That was very comprehensive and really excellent and just really wonderful information for everybody. I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Paul, and Ms. Paul is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Paul will be addressing Cancer Care's psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Paul.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you for having me. I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people diagnosed with multiple myeloma and their loved ones. We've been talking today about managing your care and quality of life, and I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care and how Cancer Care can be a part of that. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, which is face-to-face in the New York City area and over the telephone nationally, and support groups that are also face-to-face in New York City and over the telephone nationally, and online support groups nationally and internationally. These include educational programs, practical help, assistance navigating the healthcare system, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. We are also trained to help cancer patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact in care. Adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis in all of the areas I just mentioned is an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or experiencing similar problems. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers an online support group for people diagnosed with multiple myeloma. We also provide caregiver groups that are face-to-face in the New York City area and that are on the phone nationally and online nationally and internationally. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of information not only on support, but on all of our programs, as well as your cancer diagnosis, treatment, and ways of coping as you go through this. We have learned a lot today from today's program, and there's a lot of information to digest and understand. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and for your loved ones. Should you have any questions about today's workshop or about our services, please do not hesitate to contact us. Lastly, please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thank you so much for your attention and for the opportunity to talk to you today. Thank you, Dr. Messner.
Thank you so much, Ms. Paul. That was really outstanding. And actually, and the theme really that we're hearing today is really that you're not alone, that you are part of your healthcare team, Cancer Care, all the services that are out there for you. We don't want anyone to feel they're alone. Now, we do have time for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if you don't get to ask your question, toward the end of the call, I'll explain to you how to get your questions answered. So, but we do welcome your questions. And for many people, asking a question on this program is a nice kind of preparation for asking it from your healthcare team if you kind of want to get a little extra information or tool. So that's often a very helpful method. So I'm going to ask that you get the instructions on how to ask questions. And so, Stephanie, if you could explain to the audience how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Ken J. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. Your question? Hi, Ken. Hi.
Yes. I'm just curious as to what the outlook might be for drug therapies to improve to the point where stem cell procedures won't be necessary. Is that something somebody's working actively on? Is it in the foreseeable future?
Excellent question. Dr. Bensinger, do you want to take a look at that?
I'll be happy to answer that. I think it's an excellent question. Stem cell transplant currently, even with the new drugs and combinations, has been shown to be an important component because it further improves response rates and has resulted in better disease control. Now, these newer drug combinations, especially some of the newly approved drugs in the last year, may further improve results to the point where a stem cell transplant is not needed. But I think we don't know that at the present time. I think it is potentially in the works. It's something potentially that could happen. I would like to give you an analogy to a disease that is commonly treated with stem cell transplant, and that's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, where we have drug combinations that can cure a proportion of patients. But there are still patients that recur after getting a remission, and those patients are commonly treated with stem cell transplant. So what may happen in the future is if we can actually show that we can control long-term a proportion of patients without a transplant, there's still going to be some that will recur, and they're going to need a transplant. So I don't see transplant going away completely, but it could change in terms of how we use it.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Carolyn, if I may, but Dr. Benzinger has explained it very nicely to you, Ken, but I do want you to know that we are doing a trial as we speak, asking the exact same question that you are asking. And what's happening here is patients are getting newer drugs and then, half get a transplant, half don't. The initial data, and I'm sure a lot of you saw that, the transplant seems to be doing better. But I think this is a large enough data set which is going to allow us to know there is probably going to be a subset of patients who will not need a transplant. And once we've completed the study, we'll be able to figure out who those patients are who will not need to go through the process of transplant. But in general, as of right now, our suggestion is transplant, but we are asking that exact same question that you just asked us.
This is really quite amazing that actually our participants, with a great first question, are actually really really thinking ahead into the future, just as our speakers are to some extent, as to next steps. And it's kind of amazing. So that was a wonderful kind of innovative question to start us off with, because it's really makes us all realize that the world is, of course, changing, but not quite yet. And I guess where research is happening exactly around the question that Ken Jay asked. So I really thank you for that first question. Excellent. And I think we have another question in queue. Is that correct, Stephanie? Or
yes, our next question comes from Mary P. Your line is open.
Yes, I would like to know, with the new three-drug oral combination, what's being done about funding? I know it's become an issue for many people, but for those of us on Medicare, it's a really big deal.
That's a tough question, and I think you're absolutely right. Funding, especially for an all-oral agent combination, and when you're talking about two very expensive oral drugs, this becomes a problem. Medicare certainly has limitations in terms of what it will cover for those patients. There are some resources from some of the drug companies for patients who don't have the means to afford these drugs, but I think it's very much on an individual basis.
That's an excellent point. And actually, that is an excellent question. And actually, there is concern across the board around some of the costs. I know that many nonprofit organizations also have co-pay foundations that actually sometimes assist with these issues as well. So there's quite a range of them. We do certainly recommend that you would contact our social work staff here at Cancer Care around an issue of someone struggling on the call with the cost of their care, so they can have a dialogue with one of our social workers here and see if we can help. Also, at your own institution, we are getting your care to raise that with your treating healthcare team as well, because they all also have a staff to kind of assist with it. We don't have perfect solutions right now, but we do have, we often can help with these issues, and there is a great deal of concern about this, I think, across the board. And I don't know if Dr. Schiff, do you want to add anything to this as well? But there is certainly, I know, many national meetings, the medical meetings, people are discussing these issues in terms of coming up with solutions.
No, absolutely. I think, as we keep combining more and more drugs, Mary P., we're going to have more and more of an issue of making things expensive. One thing I will say is the oral combination of IRD, which is ixazomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. It's an approved combination, it's an FDA-approved combination, and therefore, if you meet the indications, it should, as of right now, be covered. And, you know, we do tend to prescribe both exazimib and lenalidomide in combination in our patients, and we so far not have had a problem going. You know, as we continue to combine, and you heard the theme, you heard Dr. Benzinger say the same thing I kept saying, yes, there's going to be combinations and combinations. So I do think we have to think long and hard about these combinations and see what the best way of reimbursing this is. And end of the day, my sense is it's going to be, you know, insurance, drug companies, everybody coming together to try and make this happen. Because at the end of the day, I think all of these drugs are making people feel better. So we just have to know how to pay for them better. But like Carolyn, you mentioned, there are the Chronic Disease Fund exists. The Leukemia Lymphoma Society exists. You, your group, Cancer Care, has done a lot for a lot of my patients, I know. So reaching out when there is trouble to the social worker in your hospital is something which absolutely should be done. Reaching out to the IMF, MMRF, Cancer Care also would actually be helpful, I think.
There are a number of these foundations out there, and I think, as Dr. Rajay also indicated, the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, the International Myeloma Foundation, there are many organizations, the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, there are many organizations out there that are really working very hard. And, of course, these new very promising agents, we need people to, everyone wants people to be able to take them. And I know that sometimes people do get rejections from Medicare and sometimes requires an advocate to deal with, help to do to deal with Medicare. So sometimes one can get a rejection. It's interesting. I think in Medicaid, they've really researched it most carefully, and people who often appeal a rejection, sometimes those appeals go through. So it's very important to actually work with one of the advocacy groups. Those are free groups that work with you around these things. They often do have people specifically to help with that. I'm going to ask Ms. Paul if she could also just say a word about our copay foundation here and just the calls that we get here from people in terms of how we approach helping them. So Ms. Paul, if you could just say something about that as well. So indeed, just the services that we offer here at Cancer Care is we do have our oncology social workers who often will help with your, you know, with any questions or concerns you may have about financial matters, that our staff can assist to connect you to different resources we may have here, both from Cancer Care and our Copay Foundation, or referring you to other organizations that might be able to be of help. So it's an excellent question, a very cutting-edge question, and one that's really on everyone's mind, no question about that. So thank you so much for that excellent question. And we have a question from one of our online participants from Candy. I have had a stem cell transplant after being on a year and a half of chemotherapy and still haven't put me in remission. Do you think trying another stem cell transplant would be worth trying? Is there really a remission? Dr. Benzinger, could you address this question in a general way? And
yeah, so it's hard to know for sure and without details of your specific case. There are some data to suggest that a second transplant, a tandem transplant is the term I use, but it generally means a transplant, a second transplant done within 6 months of the first transplant. There are some data to suggest that a second transplant is beneficial if you haven't achieved a remission with the first transplant. So that's one approach. There is also data to show that consolidation therapy, usually with two or three drugs after transplant, can improve the depth of remission. And so it may be possible also in your case to use a two or three drug combination as further therapy. So these are generally the approaches that are taken if you haven't achieved a remission. At some point, probably maintenance therapy is going to be recommended for you as well, since that's also been shown to be beneficial in terms of prolonging the length of remission.
Excellent. And we have another online question from Michael. I am on maintenance therapy with thalidomide for almost 12 years after a tandem autologous transfer. My last kappa light chain started steadily going up. Is there a threshold of a kappa lambda ratio after reaching which a different therapy should be considered? So again, this is a first of all, particular question, but I'm wondering also, Dr. Bensinger, if you could begin by just addressing it in a general way, just some tools that Michael could have for his...
So we often try to make a distinction between what we call chemical or biochemical relapse and clinical relapse. And it sounds as though if you're the only thing happening to you is your light chain is going up, you may have what we call a biochemical relapse. That doesn't necessarily mean you need treatment, because if you haven't developed anemia, if you haven't developed kidney problems or bone problems, often that can be watched. There is no clear guideline that says when you reach a certain value that you're going to need treatment. It really depends on a constellation of other clinical variables and how you're feeling. Are you having bone pain? Are you having any symptoms? So we don't know. The short answer is we don't know exactly what level you should definitely start treatment. But as the level goes up, though, I think you need closer and closer scrutiny by your treating physician, and he can help you make the decision about the right time to start treatment.
I hope that's helpful. Dr. Rajay, did you want to add anything? Or?
No, I agree completely. Okay. No specific number.
We have a question from another online participant. From Sharon, I'm scheduled to have a stem cell transplant in a few months. How should I prepare and what should I expect? Dr. Bensinger, if you could address that question in a general way.
Well, I think in general, you need to make sure that you're otherwise healthy. So if you're a smoker, which I hope you're not, you should consider a smoking cessation. If you're a diabetic, you should make sure that your blood sugars are under good control and that you're generally taking care of yourself. You're eating well, and if it's appropriate, getting some exercise. Other than that, I think there's nothing specific that I can recommend to you for preparing for a transplant.
Excellent. And we have another question from one of our online participants. From Karen. Can exercise help maintain bone health when living with multiple myeloma? If so, what kind of exercise? So Dr. Rajay, could you address this question?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, exercise is absolutely a good thing in cancer in general, Karen. It helps you tolerate your treatment better. Outcomes in patients who actually exercise, we know, most of this literature is in the breast cancer world, but there is enough data to show that if you're active, if you're working out, you're going to do better. In terms of myeloma, I think it's important that you know exactly what your bones look like, and as long as you don't have any bones at a risk for fracture, etc., make sure you've figured that out with your treating physician. I think doing regular exercise is a good idea. For lifting very heavy objects, specifically from the floor up, etc., be careful with the back. Do the right things like going down fully and then picking up as opposed to just bending down. I generally think swimming is a great exercise for most people because there's no stress on any of your bones here, and that works quite well. And most myeloma patients can do just about everything and anything as long as there's nothing which has an impending a fracture, like a long bone, for example, your femur or your thigh bone, as long as there's no big lesion there. And if there is, that needs to be addressed. Once it's addressed, you can absolutely do full exercise. In terms of lifting weights, etc., generally, anything doing more than 30, 40 pounds, just make sure that your bones are okay to deal with that. But otherwise, absolutely, the more active you are, I think the better you're going to do in terms of toxicity, the better you're going to do in terms of bone disease as well.
Excellent. And actually, I want to take one last late-breaking question, which I know will just bring us a little bit over time, but it's an important question. We did address it. Our speakers have addressed it. It's from Jeff. But I think it might be worth kind of concluding with this as well. Are there any new developments with immunotherapy when treating multiple myeloma? So I'm going to ask Dr. Benzinger and Dr. Ajay if you could just address this important question.
There's a lot of very interesting trials with immunotherapy that are underway. There's drug combinations, adding drugs like immunomodulatory drugs to some of the new immunotherapies. I think the CAR T cells that Dr. Rajay mentioned are very exciting, and this is simply a technique where your own cells are reprogrammed in the laboratory to recognize and attack your own myeloma cells. And there was some very preliminary data at ASH that was shown that looked quite promising, that these cells can actually attack advanced disease in patients who failed multiple therapies. And so we're definitely going to see more of that. There are several of these trials that are ongoing around the world, and that's a very exciting area of research. Dr. Rajay mentioned also the vaccine trials that look very interesting, and I'll let her say more about that.
Dr. Rajay?
Sure. So, we have all been talking about, I think the next phase of excitement in myeloma is really immunotherapies. The CAR T cells, Dr. Benzinger has already mentioned, that is a platform which we think might have kind of long-term disease control in myeloma. It's still early days, but we are doing them in the context of clinical trials. Vaccines, we're using more post-transplantation so that when your disease is at its lowest, what we are doing is essentially taking out certain immune cells from your body, fusing them with the tumor cell, and then giving it back. So vaccination is a reasonable approach, but more generalizable immuno-oncology strategies are also available. We talked a little bit about some of those monoclonal antibodies, which can, whatever defects you have in your immune system with a disease like myeloma, those can be corrected with these antibodies. And when we combine these antibodies with the IMiDs, we are seeing very good responses, so that if you were, for example, on lenalidomide, Revlimid, and you stop responding and you add on a drug like pembrolizumab, there's a very good chance that you're going to respond again to that IMiD-pembrolizumab combination. So that, I think, is a very exciting opportunity, which is going to be very available to a lot of patients with not that much of toxicity. So, we are excited about this. I think you will hear more about this by the end of the year and early next year. And hopefully all of these put together are going to create that platform where patients continue to live with myeloma for a very, very, very long time.
Oh, thank you. I want to thank our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call, actually. A really transformative call in the sense of all the years we've been doing these programs, so much wonderful information that has been shared with you. To bring it back to your healthcare team, please do all that. And also, I want to remind everyone, I want to thank you all, first of all. Our speakers were amazing. All of you who asked such great questions were amazing. Some of you asking the most cutting-edge questions, actually, that are being worked on right now in clinical trials. Also, for those of you who have been listening and for those of you who may have questions that we haven't gotten to and didn't answer, so I want to do two things. First of all, I want to actually, first of all, give you resources to get your questions answered in case you have a question still or think of one tomorrow or in the next days and months ahead. Obviously, your healthcare team is a perfect place to start with any of your medical questions, but nevertheless about myeloma or any cancer issues. But we also do recommend the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237, or their website at www.cancer.gov. And also, for those of you who really want to speak with one of our oncology social workers, really about the cost of your care. That came up today a lot. That's a very important topic in terms of resources for getting help with those issues, in terms of being able to access state-of-the-art care for yourself and having someone to really advocate for you around those costs, and also referring you to the many copay foundations that exist and the many resources. Definitely call our oncology social workers here at Cancer Care. Also, for anyone who would like to have any help with counseling services or a support group or an online support group, or actually listen to one of our future programs, or actually our materials and booklets, and or also visit our website. Those are also kinds of our staff can really help you with that tremendously. And for that, you would just call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673. And our staff would be very happy to help you. And a theme that's come up throughout the entire call today is we don't want anyone on this call to think you're alone, that you are now part of the multiple myeloma community, of course, and you're part also of Cancer Care's community because you're on the call today. We don't want you to feel or leave this call thinking that you're alone with some issue or concern that you don't quite know what to do with, from either a practical or financial question to just coping issues to what type of best treatment should you pursue. And I hope that you'll take us quite seriously with that, with this kind of ending comment here, but we do want you all to know that you have many resources. And your healthcare team includes both your medical team and also all of the other personnel on that team, oncology nurses, oncology social workers, financial specialists, all the different people in your institution that can help you. And if you're finding that that isn't sufficient for you or you would like to have some complimentary services, go ahead and call us at Cancer Care as well. And we will then connect you to both our services and all the services that exist out in the community for you. So with that being said, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you so much. So I'll take care, I'm sure you'll be on one of our future – well, actually, there's a part two to this call, just before I conclude that. It's on April 28th, and it's coping with the stresses of caregiving when your loved one has multiple myeloma. So that's on that's part two. It's on April 28th, same time, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern time. And actually, I know that in previous calls, people have said, well, I'm my own caregiver, and if you are, you're welcome to join the call as well. So it's both for actual caregivers and actually for actual caregivers who are taking care of themselves, if that makes sense to everybody. So you're more than welcome to join that call. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.